I have to tell you a little bit of backstory about Richard Menzies. I don't know how many years ago it was, probably six or seven, that I had seen his posts on the original ex-Mormon Yahoo list off and on, and he wrote me one day and asked me if I was related to a person whose name I won't say because this is being recorded and he wouldn't appreciate it at this gathering. But I said, yes, he's a very close relative. And long story short, they had met each other at BYU and had spent their freshman year, or maybe it was your sophomore year, I don't know. He aided and abetted my brother's rebellious behavior for about a year. Oh, really? Okay. They aided and abetted each other, let's put it that way. I thought you told me you provided the... Oh, my gosh. I did not know. That's funny. Anyway, we've talked online a bit, and he came to one of my Thursday night parties, and I had had it in the back of my mind for a long time to have him come in and speak, and his latest book he told me about, you know, several months ago, and when I got it and read it, then I decided that, and he brought it up again, and I said, well, guess what? And so we cemented the deal that day, and I don't know a whole lot about him, except after reading his memoir, I know a whole lot more, but I know you're going to enjoy this session, and he's been told that he's a great speaker and has some great things to say, so I'll turn the time to Richard.
Thank you. This is actually my first conference, and I'm honored and pleased, and especially Friday night open mic night, I kept thinking, what a great bunch, you know. If I'd only known you people at BYU. But you had to be so guarded. Maybe we exchanged furtive glances, but we thought, is this safe? Can we talk? As it was, I don't think I met any friends at BYU. That was a big turning point for me. I never got as deeply invested in the church as many of you. I'm almost embarrassed to admit I'm unendowed.
Get up, imposter!
I never tasted the meat. That doesn't sound good either. I did taste a lot of milk, but I guess I'm lactose intolerant because it just didn't resonate. I also grew up in Carbon County, even though that is geographically in Utah. It's not culturally in Utah. You have an expression, B-I-C, born in the covenant. We have one called B-I-C-C, born in Carbon County. But we have a Mormonism light down there. And it's just sort of, you know, general guidelines. And I guess I was just a social Mormon until I got to BYU and found out exactly what I was in. I've been out, I think the last time I went to church, almost went to church, was 50 years ago. I remember dressing up in a suit and tie, going to the ward house that I loved so much and getting right to the front door and not being able to walk in. It's just like the end of, you know, it was the end of the first of my life. And it wasn't doctrinal, it wasn't anything. I just thought, I can't take one more step. It's like that Don McLean song. I couldn't take one more step. I'd come to the end of the first part of my life, which was, I thought, a happy, happy childhood growing up Mormon. But I wasn't thriving, and I wasn't going to ever be myself, whatever that was going to be. So this is the story, the place I haven't revisited, but I went back to those days 50 years ago. And it wasn't easy reliving BYU, believe me. But I'm gonna attempt to do that. And right off the bat, let's get this off. It's not literature. I mean, there's provenance, but if you learn about books and if you read books, if you know about books, there's no question the Book of Mormon is not the most perfect book. I'm surprised Joseph Smith got it published, but I guess he self-published, right? And yet, if you're in rural Utah, you see this on the tombstones. There's an equivalence between the King James Bible and the Book of Mormon. But the King James Bible, you can read it. There's beautiful passages in it. The Book of Mormon, not so much. I was born on April 6th. That seemed to be propitious. I think I was a special date. And my father was a carpenter, as a matter of fact. So I felt like a child of destiny right from the start. I had goodly parents. I thought they were good parents. But they weren't married in the temple. What happened is my mother was not LDS. She lived across the street from my dad. He wanted to marry her. He asked his bishop to perform the ceremony. He said, she'll have to repent first. And that's all he had to hear. So they went down to Fountain Green and got married by a justice of the peace and lived happily ever after until my sister forced them to get remarried in the Manti Temple. And I suppose they went through, I try to imagine my mother going through this ceremony. This is before I've heard about it. And I never saw the garments again. I never saw them in temple attire until they were in their coffins. We went right back to our usual lifestyle, you know, with coffee and wine. If Ann and I were in town, they didn't dare go to the liquor store, but we would smuggle stuff in. So there I am as a little boy in 1943. Innocent as a lamb. You don't know where you're born. You don't know what's going to happen to you. We lived in this house in Price for 50 years. Modest house. It was pretty good by our standards. I guess I'm about 8 here. That's the age where you're supposed to know everything, right? So that's when I got baptized. And just because people say it's a good idea, you know. I was the third boy. I had two older brothers. I don't know if you can tell which one's the destined to be a rebel in this picture, but that motorcycle jacket was the favorite thing I ever got. I don't know why my mother bought it. It's very subversive. And my book's a lot about my three brothers and the contest between the three of us to please our families and our community. I also had a little sister, but I don't write anything about her because, as you know, women have no issues with the church. One thing my dad had never gone on a mission. We didn't have any history of mission going in our family. But he was an excellent Boy Scout. He was the top Boy Scout in the 3rd Ward in Provo. So we all wanted to live up to his high expectations. Here I am as a Boy Scout in the 6th grade, and I believe I'm wearing my father's uniform. It looks very, and he's hoping I'd grow into it. It was nice having such a uniform. You didn't have to take a tent when you went camping. You could just take some poles. And if you had a friend, you could probably fit him in there too. One of the reasons I went to church all the time is because that's where the Boy Scouts are. And we had a really fun troop, Troop 281, Utah's first honor troop. I don't know how we earned that distinction. Everything was fun. We had a lot of fun. I liked all the aspects of scouting. Here we are at a camporee having a little foot race. I was a little different from other Boy Scouts because I was never participating in the event. I was always watching it. I seemed like I was born with a camera in my hands. And this particular race, I wasn't watching it. I was watching the people watching it. I took this picture, which won me some money. And it started me down a road to trying to make money with a camera. Here's another one, an ill-fated scout outing to Stead Air Force Base in Reno. A typical Boy Scouts, Mormon Boy Scouts, is they don't really check to see if there's an engine in the bus before they set out. We had to push this thing clear to Reno on Highway 50. Another advantage of being a photographer is you don't have to push, you just watch. And I just stayed and stayed in the Boy Scouts. I didn't want to go on. Here I am as a patrol leader, the BAP patrol, and holding the whistle of authority. This particular trip is called the Spanish Trail. Did anyone go on that? It's about 40 miles from Enterprise to Vail, southern Utah. You have to cross Hamblin Creek about 40 times. You have to go through tumbleweeds up to your armpits. Very arduous. Well, you don't have to. You could be intelligent, go around it. We stopped for the night at a place called Mountain Meadows, which I'd never heard of before. But there was a little monument over there, so I went over to read it. This was placed in 1932. Can you read it? In this vicinity, September 11th, 1857, occurred one of the most lamentable tragedies in the annals of the West. A company of about 140 Arkansas and Missouri emigrants led by Captain Charles Fancher, en route to California, was attacked by white men and Indians. All but 17, being small children, were killed. John D. Lee, who confessed participation as leader, was legally executed here March 23, 1877. Most of the immigrants were buried in their own defense pits. That's it. That's not that informative, really. It leaves a lot of unanswered questions. I've watched, every time I've gone by there, I've checked, and the monument has always been adjusted slightly. Last time I was there, I noticed the Fancher family has put up a monument. It's a little closer to the truth. In memory of the emigrant men and boys from Arkansas massacred here in Mormon Meadows on September 11, 1857, their lives were taken prematurely and wrongly by Mormon militiamen. That's a progress. In one of the most tragic episodes in Western American history. So eventually, if we live long enough, there'll probably be an informative to tell a real story. But I, growing up, I wasn't told the real story. I wasn't told any of those stories. If I wasn't with the Boy Scouts, I was with the priesthood group. In our ward, if you attained an 85% attendance rate, you could go to the High Uintas fishing in the summer. And I never missed. I was the Audie Murphy of attendance. Here we are at Moon Lake preparing to go in. And these are my friends from left to right. I'll tell you how they ended up. The guy on the left is a judge, retired judge now. Next to him is my friend Doug, who's a retired family man. The young little guy with the rabbit ears we call Pipsqueak, and he, until he got tired of it, he joined the Air Force and learned to fly an F-105, was shot down over North Vietnam, and hasn't been heard from since. The other guy, Ronnie Jensen, killed himself. Second from right, Roland Wall never went to priesthood meeting, obviously. He's on his way to becoming a juvenile delinquent. But in later years, he got religion. On the far right is Tommy Longhurst, who didn't even survive this camping trip. You know, nice as Mormon boys are, there's always just beneath that, there's a violence waiting to erupt. Those of you who've played church ball know what I'm talking about. You say a prayer that we'll be nice to each other and play nice, and then next thing you know, you're lying, you know, screaming in pain. The downside of those camping trips was this. You had to sit through these meetings. And every teacher always looked sort of like this. He was a proper return missionary. And he'd talk on about Nephites and Lamanites and Zoramites and Trilobites. I didn't know. I didn't absorb any of it. I was just thinking of trout fishing in the Uintas. He also talked about the only way to get to heaven is there's only one way, as we know. You need to follow some old guy with horn-rimmed glasses. Even if that old guy doesn't even know where he is half the time. But we heard about interesting things, too. He used to talk about the three Nephites. What happened to those guys? Have they been erased from our theology or what? That was an interesting thing. Here they are. They came to General Conference once I got their picture. I would have preferred to be stuck at a slightly younger age, but that's all right. So going into high school, as you can see, I'm socially challenged. I'm still wearing my pants at sort of empire waist level. And I'm a shutterbug, you know, and that didn't carry much prestige in high school. It says here, the flashiest men around school. Nothing went unnoticed by these carbon photographers. Well, I'll tell you what went unnoticed. We went unnoticed. We had no prestige, no juice. We were social lepers. And I think all kids think about is, how can I move up this ladder somehow? Why do I have to be stuck taking pictures of the cool kids instead of being one of the cool kids? Why can't I get a date with a cheerleader? Why do I go unnoticed by the cheerleaders? Why does nobody prefer me at the preference ball? Why do I go to dances with my camera? Why can't I be inducted into the syndicate's car club of helper? They got all the great cars, and I don't have any car. This is a reunion, actually, where Robert Downer's pretending to be a nerd, but you're not really a nerd with a cool car. This is a cool car in 61. These guys are from Helper. They're living the life I can only dream about. Because you'd have to have some mechanical skills to have something like this. My friends and I tried to build a hot rod once, but we don't know where to start. I don't think you start with a radio flyer. Although my friend Doug finally inherited a car from his brother Dexter, so we could get around, and we headed straight for the mountains. We loved it up there. And we had church ball. Doug was center, a good friend of mine. I didn't, you know, I'm taking pictures as usual because I'm not a great basketball player. A church farm, do they still have church farms? I feel like the oldest person. That was a good idea, I thought. We're putting up hay here. It was a welfare farm, sugar beets. It was like a Mormon kibbutz. It was great because the beets went to charity to feed the poor. They love sugar beets. And you got to interact with adults. This is Mr. Bailey, my chemistry teacher on the left. So boys and men were learning to hoe beets. It was good. I like that aspect of it too. Girls, Doug had this girlfriend forever. In fact, he's still married to her. So he fixed me up with this girl. This was a one-date deal. It didn't turn out. If I said I'm going on a mission, she'd say, okay, I'll wait for you. We'd be married. Finally, I got a girlfriend. This girl moved from Hawaii. I thought she was very glamorous. She had a great photographer anyway. She just lived up the street, and she'd learned to hula in Hawaii. It was really cool. She tried to teach all the girls in the ward how to hula. And she also got me involved in a whole lot of road shows. Do they have road shows anymore? Before television, you had to entertain yourselves in these wards, so you'd have to put on some kind of a show for the ward, and if it was really good, you'd circulate it around the other wards, putting on the show. Some of them are quite elaborate. But you had all this talent. You had all this talent that you had to tap into. One of the big shows was called Sand in Their Shoes, which kind of looks like an early Sound of Music. You had a whole, large families singing and dancing, talking about their trials as pioneers. Rocks in Their Socks, that was a sequel to it, I think. Bugs in Their Beds. It just kept going on. Can't guess which bug I am, can you? Most of the dating situation, because I didn't have a cool car and I didn't have athletic ability and I wasn't very good academically. But luckily in church you have a social circle. And my friends and I, we had this, it was pretty much the same gang. We'd go out, here we are in the desert having a good time. My friends are flexing their pubescent bodies, showing off how great they are. I'm taking pictures because I'm not going to try that. Water skiing at Schofield. By junior college, I think I got a job at the airport, which was sort of a beginning. I thought, I'm going to be cooler. I'm going to be a little bit cooler. I'm going to be around airplanes, and I'm going to take flying lessons. I learned to fly at 18. I flew this. I'm standing next to a J-3 Cub. It was born in 1943, the same as me. I had another job at the coolest, the men's store in town. I got to work with the coolest guy in town, Dave Pizzuto. Now you can see I'm becoming slightly less nerdy, at least in my own mind. And I had a Mercury that wasn't too bad if you didn't look too close. So I could go on single dates, finally, without the tagalongs. I even, at Carbon College, it's a very small college, I have to explain. It's two blocks from my house, and I got a full tuition scholarship. The price value, the cost value was $75. So we had a very small band, and I was named, given the whistle of authority again. But we couldn't form any large, we couldn't form large letters, capital letters. I remember, and we had to go with lowercase. So this, we're doing a salute to E.E. Cummings here. But I could twirl and I could blow that, and I felt pretty cool. As I said, as a very small student body, I was also sophomore class president and second runner-up to the homecoming queen. I was doing great. But this was the top of my career. Then I made the worst mistake I ever made in my life. I transferred to BYU. And why is this man smiling? I don't know. Because I thought I was going to have a good time. And why did this guy go to BYU? Well, my dad went to BYU. Following in Dad's footsteps, his righteous footsteps. He graduated in 1935, and he always spoke well of his wonderful times at the Y. But the Y in 1935 was quite different from the one I entered in 1963. The student body, it was the middle of the Great Depression, the student body was predominantly Democratic, probably some communists in there. But he had a wonderful time. That's him with his friends, and everyone had a nice raccoon coat. The other thing, Provo was sort of our family home because my mother and dad had both grown up there, and we had roots that went way back. Well, these are not our roots, however. This is the way pioneer life is depicted at Old Deseret. But not everybody was dressed like that, rolling hoops and wearing shovel bonnets. The Menzieses went from Scotland to Schofield, and just in time for the great Schofield mine disaster of 1900. Miraculously, my grandfather wasn't one of them. The Hearsts were religious pilgrims. They went to Colville. But my grandma, my paternal grandma, got mixed up with the Menzies from Schofield. So the link was kind of broken. It was just half Mormon. On my mother's side, things were very different. She started out life in Eureka. It's a very different, very hard rock mining town. Her father was not a Mormon. He'd come out from Kentucky. He's kind of a hobo and a hard rock miner. That's him on the left. He's on the back row here, fourth from the right. He's a member of the Western Federation of Miners, a very union activist guy. Unreligious. He married my maternal grandmother, shown here, wearing the white dress. And her family came out from Missouri. They were religious converts. And against her family's wishes, she married John Wesley Morton. You can see this house is in a place called Carterville. I finally located it. It's in Provo. It's probably sitting right about where Lavelle Edwards Stadium is right now. This is life in Eureka. We always dressed well, no matter how poor we were. My mom grew up in this house on Fifth West in Provo. Thing was, when you got a little money ahead in the mines, you went to Provo. Because it was really fertile and you could grow things. You have a cow and chickens. And the Menzies just came down to the mountains the same way. They were right across the street. Mom's old house and her garden sits where the Central Utah Valley Hospital is now. But Granddad didn't live long enough to enjoy it because he was dying of a mining-related disease. My mom and my dad at my mother's house just shortly before it was torn down. Getting back to my dad's yearbook, I was just so excited. Everyone seemed to be having such a good time in the 30s. And you lived on this great trout stream, the Provo River, Bridal Veil Falls. I heard all the wonderful times my dad and my mom and dad had up there. These are pages from the yearbook. I thought, God, what a bunch of fun they're having. Lover's Lane. What's this down here in the varieties of beards? The dean of the College of Fine Arts at the time was Garrett de Jong, the old Dutchman. And oddly enough, luckily enough for me, he was still emeritus professor of aesthetics when I went there. I had one class with him, five of us, in the old campus building. It gave me a taste of, he always locked the door and pulled the shades and said, we can talk, we can finally talk. And it was one class I really thoroughly enjoyed. I think this is George Brimhall was president of the college when my dad started. He was replaced by Franklin Harris. They were academics. These people were concerned with education. But by the time I got there, things had gone downhill considerably. Anyone remember Ernest Wilkinson? Yes. He greeted each of us as we entered. Yes. He's been described as a Tasmanian devil. He was the most ferocious, frightening person I've ever seen. A Tasmanian devil with horn-rimmed glasses. I liked in my dad's day, they had names like Education Building. But they weren't calling buildings Education Building. They were naming them after donors and general authorities. And I ended up in Stover Hall, which was named for some mission president, I think, in East Germany who donated a lot of beds and probably the architectural plans for this hall. I hate to look at it. It makes me sad to look at. First day, I climbed Timpanogos. I thought it would be a cool thing to do, and I'm still smiling. I haven't taken any classes yet. Obviously, I'm out of focus here. I'm losing my... This is every night in Stover Hall, you had to go down and have family prayer. Family prayer, and if you had any problems, you had to go to your RA Brother Apollonio, and no matter what your problem was, you had to get down on your knees and pray for guidance. And some of these guys are pretending to drink something, but of course, that didn't happen. Yeah. It's always someone photobombing your... He could hardly make this picture worse, though. Let's be candid. So after a year at BYU, it seemed like all the life had been sucked out of me completely. You know how some people would come to resemble their dogs? I'd begun to resemble my roommate. That's Stover Hall. That's what it'll do for you. The next summer, I think it's 64, when was the World's Fair in Seattle? 64. My brother had just graduated from dental school. He'd married a nice Mormon girl. He's in the middle, and he's on the way to becoming quite a big muckety-muck in the church. And I'm starting to look like a young Dallin Oaks. I don't know what the hell's going on with me. I'm completely losing it. The one thing I thought was pretty cool at BYU, I met this girl from Tingey Hall at an exchange, and we hit it off. She's an English major, and I thought, wow, it's going to work out for me. You know, you go to BYU, you meet this girl, you take her home. Why are you shaking your head? Has this happened to you? Well, nothing good can come of it anyway. But after visiting Carbon County and seeing where I lived, the thing, it kind of fell apart because she came from a higher level. And one thing I hadn't realized being from Carbon County, there is a class system because we had no class in Carbon County. We're just, everyone's blue collar. We're just working stiffs. But her father was in upper level management and he's at the level where you get called the state president and that sort of thing. And my dad would never rise beyond usher, you know, with his. So having thought it over, she told me it wasn't going to work. And I kind of went into a low-grade depression. And it wasn't so bad getting dumped, but if you get dumped and then you see your girlfriend on the arm of, say, George Clooney, you know, you think, well, okay, that's the way it goes. If you see her with, say, Mitch McConnell, you think, what the hell's going on? What's wrong with me? And I think the problem was I wasn't a returned missionary. I wasn't marriageable. I just didn't have the credentials. I hadn't gone through that obligatory rite of passage that would make me a worthy mate. And for that, I'm very grateful. Whenever I got really blue, someone would take me to see The Sound of Music, which was always playing. And Julie Andrews had become the template for the perfect Mormon girl because she had the sensible haircut and she was virginal and musical and good with lots of children. But I came out of it not just depressed but paranoid. I thought the hills were alive. It just wasn't, nothing was working for me. The following summer, I tasted beer for the first time. My friend Clark introduced me to Lucky Lager, and it was so nice. I'm pretending to be drunk, but it's only 3-point Utah beer. I could have drunk the whole six-pack. I don't think I could have. But we were commiserating. Clark had just, his mother had died, and he'd been lectured at his mother's funeral by the state president about, you know, his lack of church attendance, and I'd been dumped by this girl. So we did the logical thing. We went in the woods, and we drank ourselves and said, poor us, we're never going anywhere, are we? I retreated back into my humble dark room, content that I would never get a date. I don't care. Well, I had a cardboard girlfriend for a while. You know, the comment I often heard at BYU is, what's your problem? You look just like us. You look very Mormon. Why are you so unhappy? What are you complaining about? I thought, I guess it's just appearances. You know, you are what other people think you are. I was also a pretty good writer. There's one area that I was excelling at BYU. Was in advanced creative writing. I think Sue was in there too, were you?
I was very pregnant.
Married and pregnant. No pregnancies here. No marriages here. Clinton Larson off the left was my mentor. These were in as much as there was some sort of liberal place at BYU, I guess it was the creative writing department. And I actually liked some of these people. These people were just at the edge, and I never put it together. I thought, if I get along with people who are on the edge of the bubble, if I were outside that bubble, maybe I would find many people I could actually get on with. But Clinton liked me, and he offered me a teaching fellowship, which would have solved a lot of problems for me. I could have gone to graduate school, and I wouldn't be eligible for the draft. Because 1966 was a terrible year to graduate, because Vietnam was just getting underway. And if you didn't have a deferment, college deferment, or if you weren't married, you didn't have children, you didn't have an ecclesiastical deferment, being a missionary, you had about 6 months before you're going to get a draft notice. So I had this terrible choice between getting, you know, you couldn't wander around and think about it for a while. I worked this summer as a door-to-door salesman, some job I hated, trying to raise money to go to another graduate school, but I didn't raise enough. And at this point, my parents were kind of onto the secret that I wanted to be a writer, so they weren't going to give me any more money for anything ever. And I got out of BYU without this happening to me, I guess. It's a funny thing that when you leave that track, all those people who supported you so much disappear. There's a woman across the street who supposedly could have helped me financially. I found this note in her yearbook. I ran a lot of errands for her, and she was quite wealthy compared to the rest of us. She said, "Perhaps when you scan through this book, you will be amazed to see a mere neighbor write a note. I want to take this minute to congratulate you on being such a fine boy, to have been and still are a credit to your family, your church, and your community. It is a great pleasure. We have watched you grow into such a fine person. We wish you loads of luck in the future. And if at any time we can assist you in any way, please call on us. We feel you are one of our very small family." Well, that was a very conditional offer, because I think what she's saying, if you go on a mission, we'll help you pay for it. The only thing I ever did to impress her, I took a picture that was on the cover of a church book by Sterling W. Sill. I got screwed by Evans Advertising and lowballed on the price. They kept the transparency and didn't give me credit, but this neighbor bought about 12 of those books. She thought, "That's the greatest thing you ever did, Richard." So, lost at last, totally alone, wandering through the desert. The draft board finally caught up with me, drafted me. But I was only in about 24 hours because a psychiatrist interviewed me and said, "You are seriously depressed." And gave me a deferment, a mental deferment, which I was almost danced out of there. That's great. My parents weren't too happy, but I still had this problem. I said, "What am I going to do for a job?" So I'm probably the only person to ever join the Peace Corps for the money. Next thing I knew, I was in Puerto Rico in some training camp. And things were looking pretty good, but we had a lot of psychiatrists. I met the girl who would later be my wife. Our paths would cross again. And so it wasn't just me. Anne was also determined to be mental. Were you mental or physical?
I was a
mess. You were a mess. And so there I was again. I had two notes from psychiatrists now. attesting to my mental incapacity. A couple of friends and I, we bummed around Puerto Rico as long as our money held out, but it was getting life was becoming very austere. Mike and Charlie, they headed off to South America. I guess they were still draftable. But nobody wanted me anymore because I was, you know, every psychiatrist I met had determined I was crazy. And I wanted to stay in Puerto Rico, but I was kind of getting a vibe like maybe people didn't even want me there. So I finally made a good move. When I came home, I decided to start over. I stopped briefly in Philadelphia. Here's a nice thing about being an artist or a musician or someone who can create something. You can always take a picture. In my case, you can always salvage the day. No matter how down it is, you can take a picture. I'm very down here, but I love this picture. It says what I was feeling. When I came home, I took a job. I moved to Midway, Utah. It's just outside Heber. And I took a job at the homestead as a lifeguard. And there was this little shack down by Snake Creek that nobody wanted. So I said, it looks okay to me. Being a lifeguard, you know, I was on a pedestal. I was a special person. I don't know who put that sign up in the background. Lifeguard on duty, swim at your own risk. Lifeguarding is a great way to get mentally well. It's very meditative. And I had a lot of time to read. I started to read. This is Thomas Wolfe. This is my shelf. I had books on my shelf. And I was getting happier every day. The other good move I did, I took my Honda 50. It was the bike advertised as a motorcycle for nice people. You meet the nicest people on a Honda, or you run over the nicest people on a Honda. I traded that in on something with a little horsepower, a Honda 305 Super Hawk. I spent much of the summer of 67 just zooming up and down hills, enjoying myself, and feeling tougher and tougher all the time. That was a great investment, that bike. And it wasn't as lonely as you might think. And now, Anne, since my wife is here, I have to clarify that Paulette was a local beautician wannabe model, and we had a professional relationship, photographer and model. And she seemed to fit in with the decor of my cabin, my shack. And she also had access to hair pieces, which was great, so she lent me some extra hair. So I could take pictures just to send home and annoy everybody. This, you hadn't seen this in Vogue. I guess you didn't see this in Vogue. Short pants were all the rage. I did get one job finally in about 1970 because of my BYU degree. The state library seems to be an arm of the Mormon church, and they like that. They liked it until they called my home and my apartment, and a girl answered. And they said, you're not married. And I said, well, we're thinking about it. Anyway, this was a good job, too, because it's lots of time to read. And I was out in based in Grantsville. Oliver Twilla was a very interesting place to visit. Visit little towns I'd never heard of. And I got very interested in the West Desert, the Great Basin. And I carried that on. I got another, when I was out of the bookmobile business, I got a Volkswagen bus. And I got a job as a stringer for KUTV. The job was enabled me to run all over 8 western states and shoot some footage. Unfortunately, that beautiful bus got stolen, but I know, I'm still hurting. And I bought this one. This is my new bus, which I still have. It's 42 years old. Most of my job was just sitting around meditating, drinking beer, smoking a pipe, looking for news. I found that if you don't try too hard, something will come along. Some of the stuff we did was very sexist. I'm out in Colorado here with my wind-up camera filming a woman named Vicki Randolph, who was a uranium miner. And in those days, any time a woman had a man's job, you know, the press runs out and takes a picture. Wow. Got to be old hard hat, and when I call old hard hat after a while. Eventually, I got hired by KUTV on a full-time basis and issued this 27-foot motorhome, so we continued driving all over the West. The bad news was I was assigned a partner who, he and I didn't have too much in common, and we were always at ends, and people thought I had too big a head for a photographer. I always thought I was the smart one, and the boss differed, so they fired me. But I liked what I was doing, so I just kept doing it. I kept driving. One thing I came away with BYU is a great appreciation for people who are misfits and outcasts and don't fit in. And I had an ability to talk to them, and because it wasn't an outreach program. I wasn't looking down or looking out. I was just out there too, looking around, and got on famously. This guy, he's camped at the bottom of a mountain in Salem. Have you heard of the Dream Mine? Well, he's waiting for the millennial dawn there when they discover that Nephite gold, and they'll form White City, and they'll all be assigned. They'll be rejuvenated and assigned numerous young women. Sounds great. Floyd Eaton, he was a character who lived out in the Wendover dump. A great storyteller. Ann and I followed him all the way to Arkansas. Very photogenic. One of my favorite characters, I met this guy out on the highway, Stanley Gertz. He'd left Cleveland. Oh, he spent 30 years in all traveling the West on his knees without any pennies. Very intelligent person. And I guess he thought I was a person he could trust with it, so he gave me the manuscript he'd been working on all those years, which I just got managed to get published a couple of years ago. Trapper Jim Harrison lived out in Fish Springs. He's making this dinner. The paper plates are my idea. I didn't want to eat off his regular dishes. There's a fellow out in Gold Hill, Nevada, one-handed mine mechanic, Orville Jack. Remember Melvin Dumar? Here he is out looking for a billionaire or somebody on the road. Very interesting guy. It was a golden era, the 70s. You had all these wonderful characters. Here's a fellow down, his name's Brant Child. He's down Three Lakes out of Kanab. He determined that Montezuma's gold is buried at the bottom of this lake, but he can't drain the lake because of an endangered snail that's in the water. So he has these signs up. And I don't know if he's putting me on or not, but it's such a great story. I just ran with it. Rolling Thunder, Rolling Mountain Thunder. Frank Van Zandt built a castle out of junk out at Imlay, Nevada. This is a guy who was just going down Highway 89, and I saw him off near a place called Vermilion. He'd been putting up hay, and I just stopped my motorbike and said, "I can't explain. You look like you came out of some other era." I took his picture. I later found out who he was through a miraculous chain of events. His name is Dar Kreutzer. Wesley Coyen, the only inhabitant of Tempe Ute, Nevada. This is probably the cash cow. Was out on the Salt Flats in 71, and this strange old fellow out there with his 50-year-old motorbike. Have you ever seen the world's fastest Indian? Well, he was pretty much unknown and kind of an object of curiosity, little curiosity, but no one had taken his picture. 35 years later, a movie's made starring Anthony Hopkins in a role, and it becomes a very popular motorcycling movie. And here I have this little Kodachrome slide, sold it thousands of times. And all because I didn't follow in those footsteps. I tried, but they're not for everybody. They weren't for me. And there I am, perfectly happy, just being an outcast myself. Happy trails. That's the moral, I guess. Don't listen to what people tell you to do. I mean, find out what you need to do. And it's very hard as a Mormon, because right at that part of your life where you should be finding that out, it's interrupted. And you're channeled into this mold. And next thing you know it, you're in it so deep, it's very hard to get out of. And many of you have suffered. I'm glad I got out sooner. I didn't mind growing up Mormon, but I really wish that we were... Yeah, I wish it were a church that would just... They keep saying, we'll make our tent a little bigger, or make it a little bigger. You know, let in... they're going to let in the blacks, and we're going to let in... We'll let in the women, maybe. Maybe we'll let in the gays, but not right now. But I think it's just go outside of the tent. Just go out, and your parents are going to say, you know, they're going to think ill of you, and your friends aren't going to talk to you anymore. What you thought were your friends, but it's very conditional. It's not a good, you're not going to grow up properly. So welcome to the real world, and I'm glad I'm not living in the invasion of the body snatchers anymore. I was worried when they showed that movie and BYU classmates were cheering for the pod people, I guess. They're in the cave. I said, they're in the cave. No, I said, who are you rooting for? But, you know, you just try to get through campus by looking straight ahead and you kind of look around, but you didn't dare talk to anybody. So you're a great crowd and I'm glad to meet you. It's only 3:00. You can take a long break. As if you'd have a question. As if I'd have an answer. Uh-oh.
I always ask questions. So what kind of camera did you use during all these pictures? What was your first camera? What was your camera later in life?
My first camera was a Kodak Brownie Holiday. It cost $10. There's a fellow named Barney Divietti had a Barney's Photoshop, downtown Price. He had this $10 camera. Next to it was a sign, Easy Terms. And for some reason, I thought those were related. I went and I said, Barney, I really like that camera, but $10. I said, can I buy it on time? And Barney said, he didn't laugh or anything. He said, well, what's reasonable? He said, I'll give you $2 down and $2 a month. So take it. And he writes it down on a little piece of paper. After I paid for that, I was trying to win, the Boys Life Photo Contest. And one of the prizes was a Kodak Signet 40. For a Kodak, it was a high-end 35. It cost $74 at Barney's Photoshop. But I didn't win it, but Barney had one. So I went and I said, Barney, I'd really need a better camera. He says, well, what's reasonable? I said, $5 down, $5 down. So I bought the Signet. And I think the third one I bought from Barney was an Exacta. This shows how old I am. These are the best. That was the best 35 millimeter SLR I could find. And it was one of maybe three 35 millimeter cameras in the county. And it really wasn't. I was stuck with that until way up to 1970. I could finally afford a Nikon F, which was a far better camera. And I've had gone through the whole series of Nikons now, and a lot of those portraits were taken with a Bronica. So pretty much everything, thanks to my wife, has a regular job. I could go buy whatever I want. She has really enabled me, because it's a Peter Pan principle, you know. She's the ant and I'm the grasshopper. She said, oh, I'll have a regular job and maybe you'll hit it big. She's still waiting. Anything else?
Can you tell us how you reconnected with your future wife? Did you re-meet?
She was easily the most attractive girl in our unit, but she was grabbed immediately by some guy named Joe. Can I tell this? Well, we had about 90 people trading in Puerto Rico. We were training to go to Bogota and serve in Colombia. But they were inseparable, joined at the hip. So, but Joe got selected to go to Bogota, and Ann got rejected. So the government intervened. And we didn't have any real connection. I may have sent her a letter. I don't know if something. But I think it's 2 years later in '69. I was in San Marcos, Texas, working at a photo studio for $50 a week, and not really enjoying taking group shots and stuff. And this postcard came; it had been bouncing all around forever, you know, from Anne. Said, "Where are you? I'm in Austin." It's framed on my darkroom wall. She says, I'm in Austin. That's 30 miles from San Marcos. And I think the very next day I got $200 from the Reader's Digest. I sold them a paragraph. So I just tendered my resignation and zoomed up the road to Austin. And if people ask what I did, I said, I'm a writer. And I write for the Reader's Digest. But I never sold them anything else. But And stuck with me. We were idealistic, right? We were idealistic. And she's a Texan. She's a Texan. I dragged her back to Utah, and she came reluctantly. And I don't know if she's adjusted very well. Have you adjusted? Of course. A lot of it's been really hard, but she's my voice of reason. Like, a lot of theological questions can be settled very quickly by Anne. I remember when in 78, when the revelation came that blacks could hold the priesthood. I said, what do you think, Anne? Do you think God made a mistake? She said, why not? He's only human. And a discussion. So we don't have religious arguments in our home, and we raised one boy without benefit of religious indoctrination. It was kind of hard. I couldn't get him to drink. A special occasion, I'd say, Alex, why don't you have a glass of wine? No. I think maybe just seeing the dissipation of his parents, he didn't want to go there. I don't think it's at all necessary to send your kids to church. Not that church, but maybe some church, but they kind of imprint on how you are. Of course, every kid's different. I don't know. Maybe some kids would need to be whipped into submission, but I only spanked Alex once, and a little plastic shovel this long, and he was in a snowsuit, so he was well padded. There's his little friend, and they were spitting milk, and he spat some on me, and it kind of went whoomp on his snowsuit, on his. And after that, he still said, hey, Dad used to hit me with a shovel when I... God. And whenever you take your kid to the doctor, he's always had a black eye because he was always doing something. And the doctors are trained to watch for abused children. So he'd say, did your daddy do this to you? He said, no, he didn't. He hits me with a shovel when I got...
thing. When you put up Ernie Wilkinson's picture, you forgot to mention his book, Free Agency and How to Enforce It.
So true. The honor system, that was something. The honor system and the spy networks. My God. He did a lot to... And it wasn't as bad. It's gotten worse. I mean, it's hard to get in there now, if you can believe it. It's mandatory church. I don't think I could have managed that. I can't. I had to have Sunday off, please. And they do elaborate background checks, but I'm pretty sure that my bishop, he was losing control of me, and since I was the most righteous kid in the quorum, he thought, he can't let him get away, you know? So he put in some, I don't know if you've ever felt like someone else is yanking the strings and controlling you, you know? He'd come in where I worked, and he'd say, just theoretically, he said, if you were called on a mission, where would you like to go? I said, well, I know that God makes these callings, but I heard a lot about France from my seminary teacher who said French girls tried to seduce him all the time. I thought, France sounds promising. So he was basically sounding me out to say, well, you know, I'll give this guy, I'm not going to send him to, you know, I'll send him abroad. And when I got to BYU, I was an off-campus dorm, but then the word came down that I'd been transferred to Stover, and I'm sure that was his doing, because that was a very righteous dormitory. But it didn't have the desired effect. Well, if no more questions, you can have a longer break if you want and restart the next. Yes? I have sold many short versions are in here. The Stanley's manuscript became a book. I only have four of them out in my car right at the moment. I'll bring them in. Trapper Jim's story, I spent a year in his dugout taping him, and I couldn't get it published really because of the profanity, but I just heard recently from his grandson who found via the web, he found a picture, and he's ecstatic because he adored his grandfather, and here I've salvaged his whole life story. So next week I'm going to, at least I'm going to print him out a manuscript, and then I guess I'll self-publish it, because God knows the publishers don't really work very hard at selling books. So that's good. And you always, take pictures I took years and years ago have become valuable. I always hear from somebody. And I do art prints. I sell prints too. You can see more of my pictures on my website. Just Google me. I'm always at the top of the list.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.